oftentimes it's better to start with creativity to help you learn the facts.
Life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In with your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is the dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Dr. Sense of Purpose Post. Pope. Right. You're Denise Pope, right? It's so good to meet you.
Nice to see you. Nice to meet you.
I've heard so much about you.
So Sense of Purpose is actually a nice place to start today.
Very good.
Yeah,
very good.
Because we've got some people who study purpose, and one of the things that they, one little exercise that they do, and I've done this with students, I've done this with some of my kids, is this little Venn diagram thing. So I'm going to walk you through it. Are you game for this?
A little bit. So today we're talking with someone who works with great purpose to support those who need education the most and are least likely to get it.
Okay, just give away the lead. I was leading up to that.
So I may look very bad in this task.
All right.
But
we're going to pretend that you will do well here, okay? So here we go. First circle. What are you good at doing?
That's probably not for me to say.
What would other people say you are good at doing?
I'm honest.
Okay, that's good. Okay, you're honest.
They probably don't understand I'm bluffing about most of the other things that they would say I'm good at.
You're faking it?
Yeah, so I probably discount that.
Fake it till you make it? Okay, so but you're honest. You're honest.
I think I'm honest.
Okay.
I think I'm good at being honest, maybe too honest.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is it that you love to do? So that's circles. First circle is what are you good at? Second circle is what is it that you love to do? Makes you happy?
Tell people the truth.
Okay, see, I'm seeing a pattern.
Is this a good overlap? Is the Venn diagram working?
I think you're overthinking this just a little bit. But okay, honesty, tell people the truth. Here's another circle. What do you think society needs?
Oh, that was not the circle. I thought the third circle was going to be, and do you make money doing those things?
Okay, there are. I actually looked this up last night, and there are some people who, instead of the three circles, what do you love to do, what are you good at, and what does society need, they add a fourth, which is, and then how can you make money at it? And you look for where all those circles overlap, and that's supposed to be a sweet spot for your purpose. Does that make sense?
Oh, I'm working on it. Have I hit the sweet spot?
Well, I don't know. You love to be honest with
I'm very good at designing instruction and figuring out why it works.
Yeah.
I love to design instruction and figure out how it works. I want to believe it's a social good.
Because people will benefit from it.
That's the hope.
That's a social good.
So I got three.
And you can make money at it because you're getting paid to do, well, right now you're getting paid to be dean, but in your previous...
I'm getting paid to tell the truth, damn it.
Yeah, that's true. My gosh, we're swearing. Good thing it's Sirius XM here.
Sorry.
So I think you're doing pretty good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'll tell everybody that I have purpose.
whether you do or not. So we're really lucky because we, Amada, when we were trying to figure out how to intro this show, we came to the conclusion that you are someone at the GSE who really does have a purpose and who walks the walk and follows it. And so we are honored to have Amado Padilla here today. Amado is a professor of education at Stanford, and his work centers around student populations whose family lives pose challenges to their schooling. So this could be due to homelessness, it could be due to language or cultural differences, immigration status, food insecurity, whatever it is. Amado is there and has really worked for his whole life to make a difference with what he knows and what he's researched. So, Amado, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Denise. Thank you, Dan.
So, tell people the different ways that you've been civically engaged. Like, I was thinking of the different formal positions you've held. Just to give people a sense of, you can be an academic and you can be purposeful out in the community.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I've always believed that it was really important to be engaged civically in one way or another, as well as being an academic. I've never thought about working in the community, that sort of thing. It's just something that I'm interested in. Maybe it's also because I I had good role modeling with my parents. Mm-hmm. My parents were very involved in the community in all kinds of different kinds of ways, from their church to political activity to helping people who needed assistance of one kind or another. So they were good role models, and that's been kind of where I've been with respect to that. As an academic, I've been on the school board in Palo Alto. That was an enormous amount of work, especially in Palo Alto. In one way or another, I've been involved in all kinds of civic organizations, nonprofits in Palo Alto. Before coming to Palo Alto, I was at UCLA and tried to do the same thing, especially in East Palo Alto. Partly, I think it also has to do with the fact that I can relate to people who others might not be able to relate to academically. I'm Hispanic, I'm Latino, I'm bilingual, I'm bicultural. I come from a working class background. Somehow I ended up academically doing well, as did all my brothers. And all of us in one way or another have been very fortunate in our lives. And I'm trying to give back a little bit.
So you also love it in another way. You told me a story once about, I think it was an inauguration, where you and your wife stood in line for like 40 hours without a bathroom. What was this story?
40 hours without a bathroom? No,
I, what? Well, yeah, it felt like 40 hours, but it was, this was the Obama,
right,
at the
right.
Obama election. The night we heard that Obama had been elected, we immediately made plans to fly to Washington, D.C. We rented a hotel room. By that time, things were already full. We ended up out in McLean, Virginia. My wife, who's a very, very social, active kind of person, made arrangements with Congresswoman Eshoo to get tickets for two children from East Palo Alto that she was that were in her classes. And so we took two young women from East Palo Alto with us. We took our son and daughter with us, and so we all flew to Washington, D.C. for the inauguration, and to be sure that we had a place there. I remember it's January in Washington, D.C.
It's cold.
We got to the gate at 10 o'clock in the evening.
That is true dedication, fandom.
But we weren't the only ones.
Oh, I'm sure you weren't.
And I mean, it was just it was really cold, but we were there. It was like an event, you know. Yeah. How many times do you get a chance to do that in your lifetime?
That's amazing.
And particularly for those two kids, right?
And particularly for those two kids, yes. And for our son and daughter too, you know.
Absolutely.
And for us, and yes, it was cold. And there were no bathrooms, and because if you went to the bathroom, you lost your place in
right.
line.
Right.
So it was an event. Yeah, it was
that's
fun.
Awesome. That's awesome.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz, and we're talking with Amado Padilla today, and we're actually going to move into this question, Amado, which is, I know that right now a big part of your work is working with kids in Palo Alto who live in a trailer park,
yeah.
And you've done some amazing things there. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do, how you got into that,
yeah.
And also sort of a day in the life of a kid in a trailer park?
Yeah.
Can I just frame that a little bit?
Yeah.
So... You did a great job, Denise.
This is just something he does, Amado. I ask a question, and then Dan's like, can I ask it in a different way?
No,
is what we do.
No, I just want to clarify that Palo Alto is a place of great wealth in general. And then here is this community sitting in the middle of Palo Alto, which is not of great wealth. And
yeah.
So just because they're in the city doesn't mean they're doing well.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Good point. Thank you, Dan.
Palo Alto is a city with 9 billionaires. Possibly 10 or 11, but for sure nine billionaires living in Palo Alto. Incredible wealth, but within Palo Alto itself, there are pockets of poverty. Probably the poorest pocket of poverty is at the Buena Vista Mobile Park. It's been there since about the 1930s or something like that. Mm-hmm. And has been, it has about, and when I, in, let me backtrack. In 2012, the owner of the mobile park informed the residents that he was going to close the park. And so you had about 110 family residences, about 400 people in all, about at least 100 children, school-age children, who all of a sudden had been told that they were going to lose their homes in the next 6 months. The families mobilized and began a campaign to try to find helpers, advocates for them. I had never been to the Moba Park, frankly. I had been in Palo Alto since 1988, and this was in 2012. I had never been in that Moba Park. I knew about its existence, and I read about this in the newspaper, and there was so I just started inquiring about it. I teamed up with Professor Don Barr in sociology, who's also a pediatrician, and we said, let's go find out who lives there. Let's go find out what's the status of the families that live there, the status of the children. So we actually taught a little seminar class on research methods for undergraduates, and we mobilized a group of undergraduates, and we went and conducted a survey of the children. We were mostly concerned about their education, what schools they were in, what grades they were in, what classes they might be taking, how they were doing in school. We were also interested in their medical conditions and in their dental condition, and just how families were engaged in the community. And because I'm in education and Don is a pediatrician, we were interested in the education and health status of the children. That's how I got involved in the late fall of 2012, and I've been engaged in one way or another ever since. I typically go over two or three times a week. When the mobile park was finally purchased by the Santa Clara County Housing Authority, then it was clear they were going to stay there, and there was a need to do something with the children. So we started a little homework club. My wife really was the impetus for that. We've been running a homework club. We do it twice a week. We have Stanford students who come as part of a service learning class or just because they want to do service learning. We now have high school students from Gunn High School and from Los Altos High School. And we typically have about 15 or 20 elementary school kids. This is primary elementary, although we have now some junior middle school level kids. But a typical day for the kids.
So why a homework club?
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like a good thing to have anywhere.
Yeah.
Why was it especially important here?
Yeah. One of the things that the parents indicated when they started mobilizing for wanting to stay in the mobile park was the issue of education for their children. And so that's how parents articulated that. But what became increasingly clear is the more I was there is that the children really had no place. If you've ever been in a mobile park and lived in a home like a mobile home, some of the families only have maybe 400 square feet. And maybe there might be anywhere from 4 to 6 to 8 people in a space, and most of them are children. There's no place for them to do homework. There's no place for them to have a space of their own in this relatively small space. One of the ideas then behind the homework club was not so much homework. They all need help with homework. But it was also to find a place that would be their space, like their club space, a place that they could go to read, maybe do homework if they can get homework help if they needed, play with each other, get to know each other, just a place that they could call their own for a couple of hours a day, for a couple of days a week, and where adults would come who cared about them. And that was important to us, too. Just a place where they could see that somebody cared for them.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz, and we're talking with Amado Padilla about working with kids who live in a trailer park in a wealthy area. And I want to ask about that. So Amado has started a homework club. It's a huge help for these kids. It's a safe place for them to go. They see role models in the Stanford students and the high school students. And so do the schools know about this? What's the relationship with this and the schools? And what should people who work in schools do to help some of the population who don't live in the big fancy houses.
Yeah, the kids all go to the same schools primarily. They go to can I mention the name of the schools? They go to Barron Park Elementary School. That's where they began school. The school the teachers know about the kids. They know about the mobile park. I think everyone's well-intentioned with respect to all the children in Palo Alto, and then there's well-intentioned with respect to these children. I think there's oftentimes a disconnect between the families and the school, and the disconnect oftentimes has to do with the fact that the parents are incredibly busy. Almost every parent works two jobs. Mm-hmm. They're always busy. There's this absence of being able to be as connected as parents might want to be with their children, as I was with my children, as other people are with their children who are middle class and have human capital and social capital to be able to work with the schools. They don't have those with respect to their children. So oftentimes the parents are absent as far as the school environment is concerned. And that many of the parents don't speak English, which is another thing. The schools in the school district do have a community outreach kind of person, an advocate that kind of comes between the families and the schools. But there's only so much that the schools can do, and the gap between what the schools are able to do and what the parents are able to do for the kids is very, very wide. And we try to fill in a little bit with some of that, but it's an awful big space between what the schools are capable of doing and what the parents are able to, how the parents are able to respond.
So I've done some research studies, you know, where I bring a new model of instruction to a school, and when I do that, I have to get parental permission.
Yeah.
And my observation is when I go to well-to-do communities, the parents contact me and ask me about everything, and is this good for my kid? When I go to the less well-off schools, more immigrant populations, they just sign and they say sure. And I think the assumption is they really are trusting the schools to take care of the kids. They're not sort of second-guessing it. They're saying this is the responsibility of the schools. Where in the wealthier districts, the parents are really in there, sort of checking.
Yeah,
is this?
I think that there's a lot of that, and it's more difficult for me to really say with respect to this population because I go there all the time. People sometimes think I live there.
Okay? I just want to say because I've seen Amato in this. He's like the mayor. Everyone knows him. Everyone loves him. He knows every kid's name. Yeah. He is on them. How did you go to school today? How's it going? I mean, just he's amazing.
Awesome. Yeah.
He's amazing.
And so if I ask a parent for this, if I could do something, you know, have a child help me with something, you know, they trust me. Okay, and that's a big deal, but I think generally people who don't have a lot of human capital, social capital with respect to the education of their children have to trust, and they trust teachers, and they trust school administrators, and they trust people who they think have an interest in their children, knowing that they can't do those kinds of things oftentimes.
Right.
And so they're giving you their most precious possession, their children, and hoping that you will do the best for them.
Very good.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We will have more with Amato Padilla talking about educating kids in poverty who happen to live in wealthy areas. But actually, the lessons are for all kids, really, and what they need. We will have more with Amato next on Sirius XM.
This is Schools In.
I'm not an expert at this.
Okay.
I'm more expert than you.
When you can't read in American society, you are really left out.
With Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Amato Padilla, who is a professor here at Stanford, who also happens to be an advocate for kids in a mobile home park in Palo Alto, along with being an advocate for kids in a lot of different ways. It's Amato's more recent work, and we've been learning a lot.
Yeah, so I'd like to ask a little bit about what people often refer to as culture shock.
Yeah.
And so when I taught in this a small Indian village, very remote, happy poor, not poor juxtaposed to rich, but happy poor, right? But not...
When you say happy poor, that's sort of a weird phrase, Dan.
They had full and content lives, but they had small homes, right? 12 people in a cabin using bed sheets to separate, served as walls, things like that. So it wasn't a palatial life, but they were happy. They liked it. I liked it. The juxtaposition wasn't there. So I worked with these students, and I was sort of given guidance to do college prep.
Yeah.
So these kids who've lived in this village, they know everybody. They've probably left the village and gone into a place with roads three or four times. That's it. I finally get one young woman into college, and she leaves after 3 months because the culture shock is too great. The college is in Fairbanks. She doesn't know every person she sees. She gets homesick. She gets lost. It's too jarring. She stops. She comes back to the village and gives up on college. So these kids are younger than that, but I sort of wonder. They're in one environment. It's very intimate. You see people all the time. And then suddenly you go into these schools that have these very different norms. Mm-hmm. Do the kids walk back and forth without any trouble?
The kids walk back and forth when they're old enough. They bike back and forth, or the parents drive them back and forth. But in talking to some of the kids, one of the things they obviously notice is a difference between what it's like to have this little mobile park in Palo Alto, where they live, and the homes they pass on their way to school.
I could still imagine that they prefer their mobile park. So this young woman actually preferred the village, even though. What I was wondering was, do they find it difficult to wrap their head around the kind of demands that the school's making of them compared to the kind of demands at home?
They love their home, and oftentimes there are multi-generational configurations in the mobile park.
Yeah.
They're more reluctant to talk about the differences, which is one of the things I've found. They talk about the large houses that they pass. They talk about, in high school, the cars that the kids have.
Right.
They talk about the fact that they, kind of reluctantly, about the fact that they need to ask the school for a computer, or in middle school for an iPad. Or in elementary school, even for a Kindle. They talk about those differences of kids having those kinds of things, but they do it kind of in a embarrassed kind of
it's about money.
They understand what their situation is. They also don't have friendships typically outside of their community. They don't have deep friendships where they go visit somebody else's home or have sleepovers, and they're certainly not going to have someone come to their house for a sleepover.
Right.
It just doesn't happen, and they rarely ever get invited outside to parties or other kinds of things. And I think they feel that, and they know about that. They're very reluctant to talk about that. That's part of that culture shock.
Interesting.
And also, they're on free and reduced lunch oftentimes, too. They know that. And their clothes are not the best. One of the things that's also, we have really good people in Palo Alto, and lots of people donate books and other things to them. There are people that want to donate clothes. But typically, the clothes that people donate are really not the best, especially if you are conscious of how your peers are dressing in the school.
People are like donating Christmas sweaters. Yeah. You know, it's not that bad.
It's also hard because how you dress as a kid, I'm thinking about the middle schoolers, you know, makes a difference. And so you don't, and you have your own style, and you have, it's not usually what comes in the bin.
Yeah. And part of the culture shock, too, is just your parents. You know, the parents are oftentimes non-English speaking. Okay, the kids are acculturating very, very rapidly, or all bilingual, and then your parent doesn't quite know what's going on at the school, and you have to explain it to them.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're talking with Amado Padilla about the reality of life in a mobile park and the kind of culture shock you do face when you go to a school with wealthier kids. And
So have you ever, either of you, seen great examples of how schools address this kind of situation?
Well, I can say that I know there are schools that have now washing machines at the school because there are kids who don't have access to washing machines to clean their clothes, and you can just go there quietly and do it. Obviously, free and reduced lunches. But, Amado, you see more what Palo Alto's been doing.
I think that's a really good question. There have been times when I've been actually – it hasn't happened recently – about how kids are coming to school, both in terms of their physical appearance, maybe a little bit unkempt, and then clothing-wise as well. What you don't realize oftentimes in a mobile park, and I certainly didn't know this, they're not most of these a lot of these places don't have bathing facilities.
Right.
Okay, there is a common bathing facility in the mobile park, one on one side for women, on one side for men. Oftentimes, the children don't go to those, but the adults do. And bathing is an issue. Mm-hmm. In the winter, it's a major issue. Mm-hmm. Okay, washing is difficult. There are a few little washing machines at this location. People don't prefer to go there because it's only three or four washing machines and one or a couple of dryers.
Yeah.
So you have to have a lot of quarters, and you have to either go there or you have to go down the street someplace.
Yeah, you have to time it just right.
I would say this as a way to sort of kind of wrap things up. I think people are under the assumption that if you can get your kid into a good school district and you can sort of be living in Palo Alto, even though you aren't living in a big mansion, this is an overall positive. This is going to be a huge step up for them. Would you agree with that?
It is. Well, I told you the parents wanted to stay. One of the reasons they advocated for staying in the Mo Park was they want because of the education for their children. Mm. They do recognize that there are more resources in this school than there might be in East Palo Alto, for instance. There might also, the schools are also safer, which is a very important part mm-hmm. for them. They also recognize that there are community resources. I mean, there are outreach coordinators that the school has, translators that the school has. There are resources that they do take advantage of to some extent. There are public libraries that they take advantage mm-hmm. of to some extent, okay? But there's only so much you can do when you're working two jobs, when you don't speak English, when you don't have a lot of education yourself. One of the things, you know, telling people who don't even college-educated people who haven't gone to school in this country, what it's like, why you need the A to G requirements to get into a state university is a complicated kind of thing. And that happens very, very early. You have to have all kinds of resources to help parents understand that.
So thank you, Amado. Thank you so much for being here. And thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app, on iTunes, or on SoundCloud.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.